Welcome back to the emdocs.net podcast. I'm Brett Long, and I'm joined by Manny Singh. Today, we look at two great pieces on managing the unstable patient with atrial fibrillation and complications of cardiac ablation. Atrial fibrillation is really common, but AFib with rapid ventricular response can cause some major issues. Hemodynamic instability is defined by systolic blood pressure less than 90, altered mental status, cardiac ischemia, or severely decompensated heart failure due to the underlying cardiac rhythm. And while these are good guidelines to keep in mind, remember that stability really exists along a clinical spectrum. So Manny, let's go ahead and talk about some pearls.
It is easy to fall into the trap of seeing a hypotensive patient in AFib with RVR and assuming that the arrhythmia is a reason for the hemodynamic instability. While this may be the case, don't forget that another underlying process may be causing the hypotension, and that the arrhythmia may be the innocent bystander. This can be especially true if the patient has a known history of atrial fibrillation. Make sure to evaluate for other causes of shock. If another cause of shock is identified, maybe hypovolemia, hemorrhage, sepsis, or a pulmonary embolism, treat the underlying cause first. Treating the compensatory tachycardia may actually worsen the situation. One helpful tip is that if the heart rate is less than 150, the hypotension is likely caused by something other than the arrhythmia. If the heart rate is greater than 150, the arrhythmia is more likely to be the culprit. Once the underlying cause is treated, their heart rate should decrease appropriately when you reevaluate the patient. If they are still just as tachycardic and hypotensive after the primary intervention, the arrhythmia may be playing a role after all. If so, cautiously proceed with the steps we will discuss later. Another very important point is to beware of patients with Wolff-Parkinson-White, or WPW. If your patient is in AFib with a rate greater than 250 and a wide QRS complex, think WPW. Don't block the AV node, or you can send them into ventricular fibrillation. In these cases, it's easier to electrically cardiovert your patient.
All great points, Manny. But let's move on to management when you think the atrial fibrillation with RVR is the primary issue causing the hypotension. And the first step that most of us reflexively think of when we hear unstable AFib is synchronized cardioversion. And let's start by talking about pad placement. There are studies comparing the anterior lateral versus anterior posterior pad placement for cardioversion, but the results are really conflicting. Some studies show no difference, while others show a higher chance of success when using the AP pad placement. And for this reason, many experts advocate for the AP pad placement. If you have time to sedate before delivering the shock, it's a good idea to do so, and your patient will really thank you. Now, you have a couple options in terms of medications and dosing. You can use etomidate, ketamine, and propofol, but you're going to want to use appropriate dosing for these patients. And what I mean by appropriate dosing is to reduce your dose that you provide in these patients. In other words, if you're thinking about using ketamine, use 0.2 to 0.5 mg per kg. And for propofol, you might want to use 1/10 to 1/4 of the normal dose for induction. For etomidate, you can consider using 0.1 mg per kilogram IV. Once the pads are in place, you have your medications ready to go. Charge up to 200 joules, synchronize, and get ready to deliver a shock. We're often taught to start out low and step the energy up as needed, but a recent study showed a higher first-time success rate when you start out high at 200 joules. Another thing to think about is placing some pressure on the pads using an old disconnected paddle. The optimal pressure is about 8 kilograms, and the reason why is that you have to think about transthoracic impedance. And this is the body's resistance to the flow of current. The goal of cardioversion is to deliver as much current to the myocardium as possible to cause depolarization, and by reducing the transthoracic impedance, you're increasing the amount of current delivered to the myocardium. The next thing to think about is anticoagulation. We're taught to anticoagulate our patients before cardioverting them if their arrhythmia has been present for 48 hours or more, or the duration of the arrhythmia is unknown. But in these patients who are unstable, it's going to be very difficult to assess the duration of the arrhythmia, and you really need to think about anticoagulation in these patients. Now, most of us know the textbook answer is to cardiovert our unstable patients in AFib, but what happens when this fails?
Start first with controlling their blood pressure. Ultimately, to control the BP, you have to fix the heart rate, but your patient is already tanking. The drugs to control the rate will drop the blood pressure even more. For this reason, we need to temporarily stabilize the blood pressure. Phenylephrine is a good choice because it gives you alpha-1 vasoconstriction without stimulating the beta receptors and raising the heart rate. In addition to giving their blood pressure a boost before giving them an AV nodal blocker, raising their blood pressure will allow the coronary arteries to fill better, which means better cardiac perfusion. A well-perfused heart will be more likely to be responsive to a medication given in the next steps. You can give phenylephrine as a push, giving 50 to 200 micrograms every 1 to 2 minutes as needed to get a goal diastolic pressure greater than 60. You can also start a drip 40 to 180 micrograms per minute and titrating to the same goal. Alternatively, you can also start a patient on norepinephrine as it's easily available and nurses are more comfortable with it. Now that we have their blood pressure looking a bit better, it's time to control that rate. In stable patients, we like to use a beta blocker or a calcium channel blocker. In the crashing patient, amiodarone is a better choice because it doesn't negatively affect the blood pressure as much as the previously mentioned medications. Amiodarone can be given first as a 150 mg bolus, pushed slowly or over 10 minutes, followed by an infusion at 1 mg per minute IV. You can redose the 150 mg bolus 2 additional times if the rate does not respond after 30 to 40 minutes. Esmolol, a cardioselective beta blocker, is great for its quick on and off properties. It quickly takes effect, can be titrated to effect, and has a short half-life, which means we can turn it off and quickly have it out of their system if their blood pressure drops. One study recently done in ED patients showed that esmolol had a better rate control than amiodarone with similar effects on blood pressure. When you start esmolol, bolus a loading dose of 500 micrograms per kilogram over 1 minute, and then start an infusion of 50 micrograms per kilogram per minute for 4 minutes. If the desired effect is not reached, you may increase in 50 mics per kg per minute increments until the max dose of 200 mics per kg per minute is reached. If you do choose to use diltiazem, don't give a big dose like we do for stable patients. Instead, use a slow drip or small frequent doses. Once you achieve the rate you want, you'll need to either start a drip or give an oral dose of diltiazem to maintain lasting rate control. It is currently recommended to avoid the use of non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers in patients with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction due to the negative inotropic effects, which is true for both the crashing and stable patient. The initial dose of diltiazem is 2.5 mg per minute over 10 to 15 minutes, or a 5 mg dose every 1 minute. Once a desired rate is achieved, you can leave the drip at 5 to 15 mg per hour, or give them 30 to 60 mg PO.
Really important points on push-dose vasopressors and other medications like amiodarone and esmolol. But the other things you need to think about are first electrolytes. If the patient isn't responding to your treatment, another tool in your box is magnesium. Magnesium can work synergistically with other AV nodal blockers to help slow the rate, and your dose is 2 to 4 grams over 10 to 15 minutes. Another electrolyte to consider is potassium. One recent study showed that maintaining serum potassium greater than 3.8 is associated with increased rate of first-time success with cardioversion. If none of this has worked so far, try cardioverting again. But if they aren't responsive at this point, there's a high likelihood that something else is really going on, and you need to reevaluate for other causes of their shock.
As Britt mentioned, if you've gone through the entire management algorithm and you're still unable to rate control your patient, there's a high likelihood that this is not just AFib. We have to go back to the drawing board and broaden our differential. Recall the pirate's mnemonic for the etiology of AFib and run through these causes to try and determine what else is going on. P stands for pulmonary causes, and this includes pulmonary embolism, OSA, and COPD. I is for ischemia or infarction. R is for rheumatic heart disease. A is for alcohol or anemia. T is for thyrotoxicosis or toxins. E is for electrolytes or endocarditis. And S is for sepsis. There are certain things such as thyrotoxicosis and severe electrolyte derangements that make AFib refractory to treatment. And in these cases, you need to treat the underlying cause first in order to get the arrhythmia under control.
Let's end this part with some take-homes. First, don't prematurely assume that the hypotension in your patient with AFib is due to the arrhythmia alone. Do a thorough evaluation for other causes of shock before lowering the heart rate. When cardioverting your unstable patient with AFib, do it right the first time. Start out big at 200 joules and consider adding external pressure to the anterior pad. Use push-dose vasopressors or a drip to stabilize the BP before trying to control the rate. Finally, consider amiodarone or Esmolol as the drug of choice for rate controlling in the crashing patient with AFib.
Our next post is on complications of cardiac ablation. Cardiac ablation has been a common procedure for complicated arrhythmias since the 1990s. For tachyarrhythmias such as supraventricular tachycardias, atrial fibrillation, atrial flutter, and Wolff-Parkinson-White, ablation is often the next line treatment after failed medical management. During ablation, multiple catheters are passed through a vein or artery into the heart. The catheters include a mapping catheter to identify abnormal electrical activity and an ablation catheter to heat the abnormal pathway via radiofrequency energy. The heated tissue, most often near the pulmonary veins, is then scarred in order to prevent the transmission of abnormal signals. Ablation procedures have increased 138% over the past 10 years, with the majority being for atrial fibrillation. The overall complication rate of cardiac ablation has been shown to be around 6.29%. Most common complications of procedures were cardiac, vascular, and neurological. Cardiac tamponade was shown to be the most common complication with a rate of 1.31%. The independent risk factors for complications included older age, complex procedures, female gender, and lower hospital volumes. Ablation for ventricular tachycardia had the highest complication rate at 9.9%, possibly due to the majority of cases being non-elective. The patient population with ventricular tachycardias also had the highest rate of comorbidities. White males were the highest population undergoing catheter ablation. However, SVT ablation was the highest in women.
Let's focus on some complications that we can't miss in the ED. The first one is atrioesophageal fistula. This is rare, but a really deadly complication of cardiac ablation. And like Manny said, this has the second highest mortality rate after tamponade. The average time to presentation is 19 days, but it can present up to 60 days later. Unfortunately, the underlying pathophysiology is pretty tough to understand. There are a variety of potential causes, like direct thermal injury, ischemic injury, acid reflux, and even infection from the lumen. But esophageal ulcers probably have a role to play. Ulcers are thought to be the precipitating event to a fistula formation. This fistula can lead to some places with some devastating complications. For example, if the left atria is involved, the clinical presentation may resemble endocarditis with septic emboli. Patients may present with a sepsis-like picture or even with neurologic complications in the later stages of disease. But in the beginning stages, patients may present with nonspecific symptoms like chest pain, nausea, vomiting, dysphagia, hematemesis, and melena. In a review of 53 cases of atrioesophageal fistula, the most common presenting symptoms were fever, neurologic deficits, and hematemesis. The key takeaway from this section is that if atrioesophageal fistula is on your differential, prompt diagnosis is essential as patients can quickly decompensate. Obtain a CBC, blood cultures, lactate, and complete metabolic panel. But honestly, your go-to test of choice is going to be a CT chest with IV contrast, which can be diagnostic in up to 98% of patients. The other big takeaway is that without the emergent surgical treatment, mortality can reach 100%. So you need to emergently consult your cardiothoracic surgeons. Also provide broad-spectrum antibiotics, including coverage for MRSA.
Delayed cardiac tamponade is a rare yet deadly complication. Cardiac tamponade is a known complication of cardiac ablation. However, emergency medicine physicians must keep delayed presentations on the differential for post-ablation patients. In one meta-analysis, 45 out of approximately 28,000 ablation cases resulted in delayed cardiac tamponade. The average number of days to presentation post-procedure was 12. During ablation procedures, tamponade is caused by mechanical trauma to the myocardium via heat, most often during linear atrial ablation and higher frequency power. The most common presenting symptoms were chest pain, edema, shortness of breath, and the feeling of doom. Surprisingly, only 13% of the 45 patients presented with hypotension and shock. 85% into the emergency department for their initial care. Patients may also present with a classic Beck triad, which consists of hypotension, jugular venous distension, and distant heart sounds. However, lack of these findings does not rule out tamponade. The hallmark of cardiac tamponade is pulsus paradoxus, where systolic arterial pressure drops greater than 10 millimeters of mercury during inspiration. Obtaining an EKG may show decreased QRS voltage globally or electrical alternance, where there is an alternating QRS amplitude or axis. Cardiac tamponade is a bedside diagnosis, but can be quickly assessed at bedside with point-of-care ultrasound. There's a great link to a prior EM Docs ultrasound post on pericardial tamponade within the article, so check that out for some common findings you can look for on POCUS. Since cardiac tamponade is preload dependent, start patients on judicious isotonic fluids to increase the cardiac output. If needed, dobutamine is the ionotrope of choice for hypotension. Ultimately, the patient needs a pericardiocentesis, and this can be performed emergently in the setting of cardiac tamponade physiology. Cardiologists should be consulted as patients may need further intervention such as a pericardial window in the cath lab.
Thromboembolic events leading to cerebral ischemia is another complication of ablation, especially for atrial fibrillation. The overall risk for stroke ranges from 0.2 to just under 1%. Thrombi can form due to direct trauma, increased turbulence from sheath introduction, or heat from the catheter tip. Patients with cerebral thromboembolic events will present with neurologic deficits. And keep in mind that recent cardiac ablation is not a definitive contraindication to TPA. Aortic embolism can also occur and may present as altered mental status, seizures, or focal neurologic deficits. As we talked about a little bit earlier, atrioesophageal fistulas can also present with aortic embolism and need to be considered. For patients with aortic embolism, treatment is supportive with supplemental oxygen, fluids, and placing the patient in head-down position. Patients may also need hyperbaric oxygen therapy.
An unusual complication that can happen is atypical migraines. For unknown reasons, transseptal catheterization during ablation may lead to new onset migraines. In one study, out of 2,069 patients undergoing ablation, 1.1% had new onset migraines. Interestingly, patients that had a therapeutic level of warfarin anticoagulation during periprocedure period had less migraines. There's also an association with isolated visual auras described as a scintillating scotoma. These symptoms usually resolve after 1 month post-procedure. The most important task in these patients for emergency physicians is to rule out stroke. Once CVA has been ruled out, the patient will need outpatient referral to a neuro-ophthalmologist.
This is a great post, and let's cover some take-homes. The overall complication rate for cardiac ablation is 6.3%. The two big ones you need to think about are delayed cardiac tamponade and atrioesophageal fistula. Delayed cardiac tamponade may occur even up to 7 weeks out from ablation. Atrioesophageal fistula has up to 100% mortality without surgery. If you think this is present, emergently talk with cardiothoracic surgery and provide broad-spectrum antibiotics. Fatal aortic embolism can also occur in the setting of atrioesophageal fistula. Stroke can occur due to a thromboembolic event, and cardiac ablation is not a contraindication to TPA. Atypical migraine is a rare post-ablation complication and should be considered a diagnosis of exclusion.
That rounds out our summary of this great post on AFib with RVR and post-ablation procedures. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, and stay tuned for our next episode. Feel free to comment on our site and let us know if you have any feedback. Stay safe and healthy, everyone.